From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook with a special live taping of On Point with WPLN listeners at the Tennessee Performing Arts Center in Nashville, Tennessee. To our listeners around the country and here in the hall in Nashville, welcome. It is great to be right here with you. Across the country, Nashville is best known as Music City, and it is that. Emmylou Harris is out with her new album with Rodney Crowell right now. Taylor Swift lives just down the street. But Nashville is also a major medical center. That has our attention, too. The healthcare industry is the city's largest and fastest growing employer. It drives nearly $30 billion in business and more than 200,000 Nashville jobs. Nashville has more than 2,000 hospital beds and is home to HCA, the largest private healthcare operation in America. So it is big. Now, 3 years ago this month, President Obama signed the Health Care Reform Bill, the Affordable Care Act. Last year, the Supreme Court upheld the individual mandate. And this year, just 6 months from now, the rollout begins. October 1st is the start of enrollment. Obamacare, as even the White House now calls it, is right in front of us. We have come to Nashville to ask what people see coming, how they are preparing, what the Affordable Care Act will mean. This hour, in a special edition of On Point, rolling out Obamacare, we're getting the view from Nashville. We're not taking calls this hour. We've gathered questions this evening from our live audience here in Nashville and all week long at the On Point website. And you can comment as well at onpointradio.org and on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have a powerhouse panel with us on stage here at the Tennessee Performing Arts Center. Let me introduce them. Former Tennessee Governor Philip Bredesen is with us, a Democrat. He stepped down in 2011 after two terms. He was mayor of Nashville from 1991 to 1999. Before entering politics, he was in the health care business, including founding and running Health America, a managed care health care company. And he is author of Fresh Medicine, How to Fix, Reform, and Build a Sustainable Health Care System. Governor Bredesen, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you right here.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Also with us, Dr. Wayne Riley, president and CEO of Meharry Medical College in Nashville. Meharry was the first medical school in the South for African Americans. It specializes in training primary care physicians who care for underserved patients. Dr. Riley is a senior health policy associate at the Robert Wood Johnson Center for Health Policy, a professor of internal medicine at Meharry and Vanderbilt, and on the board of HCA, the healthcare giant. Welcome to On Point, Dr. Riley.
Good to be here, Tom. Good to be here.
And to round out our superstar lineup, we're joined by Lawrence Van Horn, Executive Director of Health Affairs at the Owen Graduate School of Management at Vanderbilt University, Associate Professor of Management and a leading national thinker on healthcare management and economics. Larry Van Horn, it's great to have you with us.
Tom, my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
All right. Here comes Obamacare. Let's get our cards on the table first. Wayne Riley, I know you're for it. Larry Van Horn, I know you've been very critical of it. Governor Bredesen, you've been a little of this and a little bit of that. I want to hear it from everybody. Wayne Riley, let me come first to you. Why have you supported Obamacare?
Thank you, Tom. Delighted to be here. Health care is one of the most important parts of our national life, and we do know that in spite of all the abundant things that we do well in America, health care has not been one of them in the aggregate. And so that's why I vigorously supported the Patient Protection Act and the president's attempts at beginning reform of the healthcare system. And I don't think anybody is under any illusion or delusion that this is the end-all and be-all of reforming the healthcare system, but I think it's a pretty decent start.
Larry, you've been very vocal in opposition to it. In a nutshell, what's your problem with the Affordable Care Act?
Tom, I guess...
Not generally.
Yeah. My big concern is the sustainability of being able to provide the level of benefits that are deemed essential through the health insurance exchanges for states to be able to support the Medicaid expansion and for the federal government to be able to continue to support the insurance subsidies up to 65% of the federal poverty. I mean, 65% of the population And all of this is against the backdrop where we've got Medicare solvency and sustainability issues. So it's, to me, imperative that we step forward and address and put the healthcare funding mechanism on a sustainable path so that the plurality of Americans, everybody here I think would agree, should have access to a certain level of healthcare. The question is, how much can we support over the long haul? And those are the questions, the trade-offs that I think we've really avoided to date.
Even though it's rolling at us right now, even though enrollment for the Affordable Health Care Act, the health reform, starts on October 1st.
It does.
It's right in front of us. Governor Bredesen, you once called Obamacare the mother of all unfunded mandates, I'm reading here. More lately, you seem to have warmed to it. Where do you stand on it as we talk right now?
Well, first of all, to be correct, I called one aspect of it, which was forcing the Medicaid down states' throats. That was the description of that, not the Affordable Care Act in general. My criticism or critique of it is that I think it represents a huge lost opportunity. I am completely in favor of, and I think it's wonderful that we've expanded the coverage and made health care accessible to more people. At the same time, it was an unparalleled opportunity to also do some of the tougher things that it's going to take to make it sustainable in the way that that Larry has talked about. And I think we passed on all that. We took this unique opportunity with a new president and things coming together and really only used it to double down on an old way of managing health care, putting a lot more people in it. It's a lost opportunity. Today, what I tell people is, look, it's the law of the land. It's not going to change. The job now is to take what we have and, as you said, Doctor, to move forward and say, okay, how do we now take this and turn it sideways and fix it so that it can be more sustainable and it is fairer in the long run?
Even as it's about to roll out, there remains a lot of resistance to it, a lot of non-cooperation in Washington and around the country. Before we zero in on the health industry in Nashville, let's look at Tennessee for a moment. Your successor, sitting Governor Bill Haslam, has just, in December, he said, no thanks, we won't set up our own exchange. We'll let the federal government do it in Tennessee. And just in this last week, he has said no thanks to the expanded Medicaid element of Obamacare, which is the primary kind of hopper for capturing low-income Americans or Tennesseans and providing them with health care. He says no to that, even though the federal government is saying it will pay 100% for that for the next, 3 years and a big chunk of it beyond that. Do you think your successor is correct in having said no? He's not the only one who has. Big states, Texas and more, have done it. Is he right or wrong to have said no thanks?
Well, I'm not going to sit on the sidelines and kibitz about what my successor did in this thing. What he has tried to do, and he and I have talked about it, I think, was to try to find a slightly different way of approaching it, which was to use the exchanges themselves as the vehicle rather than expanding Medicaid.
So he wants the federal money, but he doesn't want to do it Obamacare's way. He wants to send those people to private insurers through the new exchange.
No, he wants to do it the Obamacare way, in the sense that, but he wants to use the Medicaid system as the vehicle for financing that. The exchanges are a part of the Affordable Care Act,
yes,
as well. And I think there's a lot of advantages to that if CMS and so on would agree to it. In the end, I hope that if that doesn't work, I hope they'll come around to accepting the Medicaid because, you know, we're paying for it, whether it be through the borrowings or through the taxes that come out of Tennessee, and it's a shame to turn down that much coverage for that many people.
Dr. Riley, if Tennessee and other states in the end don't accept that federal money on the Medicaid front, won't the healthcare industry freak out? That's a lot of money that won't be coming.
Well, the industry may freak out, but I worry more about the folks that may not get care. You know, Medicaid, in spite of sort of the noise that we hear, is not a bad program at all, Tom. And if there's been a good data that suggests that folks who are on Medicaid, whether it's in Tennessee or in Oklahoma or Louisiana, feel better about their health, have fewer complications from health conditions, are able to get in to see a physician, and in other words, their overall quality of life is much better than someone similarly situated who didn't have any coverage at all. So I approach Medicaid as a key part of the safety net. It is the scheme that the president and the Congress came to in terms of trying to expand care. And again, I agree with the governor that I applaud Governor Haslam for coming up with a sort of a novel solution, and we hope that it's successful. But if not, I do think then that we're going to have to look hard at not passing up that money to take care of more Tennesseans.
Let me ask you, Dr. Riley. We'll see how the politics of this work out and where Tennessee's governor ends up coming down. But as we sit here in this week, just 6 months before enrollment now, is Nashville ready for Obamacare? Do people understand what's coming? Do patients understand? Does the healthcare industry understand?
No, I think that, and I think the governor and Larry will agree that just recently, Kaiser Family Foundation came out with yet another poll that took the temperature and awareness of the program across the country, and we're not surprised. There's still a lot of people who do not understand elements of this legislation. It's a complicated piece of legislation. The governor described it well, that it's sort of a gamish of things brought together through congressional action, both in the House and Senate, with the White House pushing another angle. There's lots of mythology out there. There's lots of sort of misrepresentations. And I think that's contributed to even 3 years after. We just celebrated the March 23rd early this week, the three-year anniversary of the president signing the bill. There's still a lot of confusion. So I think that contributes to some of the uneasiness that we all perceive.
We're going to dive into that tonight, see what's ready, what's not, what people understand, what they don't at this point. I mean, January 1st of 2014, the coverage is supposed to begin. Millions and millions of Americans, many of whom have been uncovered, supposed to have coverage at that point. Dr. Wayne Riley, please stand by from Harry Medical College. Governor Philip Bredesen, former governor of Tennessee, is with us tonight in Nashville. And Larry Van Horn of Vanderbilt, it's great to have all of you right here. Right here in the hall, we're taking your questions, and we'll be putting them in just a moment from around the country. We've got a lot of questions in from you, and we will put those as well. This is a special edition of On Point from the Tennessee Performing Arts Center in Nashville. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point, being taped before a live audience at the Tennessee Performing Arts Center in Nashville, Tennessee. It is just 6 months now to the October 1st date when enrollment begins for the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. January 1st, 2014, not long behind, that new coverage is supposed to begin, covering millions of Americans who have not been covered, in some cases, at all. There are big implications for every American, and especially for big health centers like Nashville. With us in Nashville, Lawrence Van Horn of Vanderbilt University Owen Graduate School of Management, a big figure there in thinking about our healthcare system. Dr. Wayne Riley is with us, President, CEO, and Professor of Internal Medicine at Meharry Medical College here in Nashville. And the former governor of Tennessee, Philip Bredesen, is with us. He's author of Fresh Medicine, How to Fix, Reform, and Build a Sustainable Healthcare System. We've got a big audience with us here in Nashville. They've got lots of questions, and so do we. Larry, let me bring it to you. You're not confident about the sustainability long term, but we're looking at a rollout here. This is right in front of us. How do you think Obamacare is going to most immediately be felt by the Americans that it touches? How are they going to feel it, see it, know it's arrived?
Well, in the short run, the most pressing challenge will be meeting the demands placed on our healthcare delivery system by the increased expectations of upwards of 32 million more Americans who have greater access. And we know that when folks are insured, they consume more. We have a nice experiment that was just conducted by the state of Oregon where we covered and increased the coverage in the state of Oregon. And folks who are newly eligible for Medicaid consumed about 25% more healthcare than they would have otherwise. We're going to have access issues, and we're also going to see employers having to deal with making the decision about whether I continue to offer health insurance to my employees, particularly the smaller insurers, or whether smaller employers, or whether I'm going to move them to the exchanges. And that's a decision that many employers are going through right now.
All the states have had the option of setting up their own exchange where different health insurance options will be available, supposed to be there in fairly simple language so that people can come in, see what level of coverage that they want. Dr. Riley, Tennessee has said no thanks to putting up its own. It's gone for the federal version. What are you hearing about that? This is a big challenge just to get all this put together, coordinating the IRS and Social Security so that they can tell who's a citizen, who's eligible, what's your income level, so that what kind of support do you qualify for? Does it look like it's going to be ready? Can you tell?
Well, if your HHS is to believe, they will be ready. Now, the problem is, I think the challenge for the administration and the Department of Health and Human Services and the secretary is that you will have a patchwork of some states who've decided to go alone and form their own exchanges, then those who have defaulted to the federal government, Tennessee is an example, and then others. I think there's at least two or three that are going to have a sort of a hybrid. So that is a management challenge. I think all of us sort of, you know, scratch our head at. However, you know, the real action is that the exchange will provide the average consumer the ability to go online, compare health insurance plans, you know, between A and B, and to make a decision based on their family situation, their income. If their income level hits a certain level, they will be able to access or apply for the subsidy. So it's a very different way to get to health insurance that I think it's going to it's our way of our modern life. We shop online now for tires or books or music. Now we're going to be able to shop online for our insurance policy.
Governor Bredesen, remind us here, roughly, broadly speaking, who's going to be eligible for what?
Well, people who there's a set of standards of people who do not have insurance through their employers, mm-hmm. or a set of standards, who would be eligible to be part of the exchanges. And then depending on the income of those people, they get a subsidy toward the payment of their premium for the exchanges. So that piece of it is there. You know, the problem with what we've done in the state of this, and again, I'm not trying to second guess the governor here, but you know, you're in effect turning over a huge piece of the healthcare system in the state of Tennessee and a lot of its future to the federal government.
By letting them build the exchange,
which is an odd place to be if you're a very conservative person who's opposed to the, you know, who's opposed to the exchanges. And I think it's kind of a sort of some fallout of just the sort of incredibly divisive atmosphere that surrounded the politics that surrounded the Affordable Care Act in the first place. And I think that's unfortunate, but, you know, the opportunity will appear, I think, again, around down the line for us to come in and operate our own exchanges, and I hope when that opportunity comes that we'll take advantage of it.
Do you see this being ready to go? 32 million more people, or the Obama administration says maybe 40 million more. Is it ready?
Well,
will it be?
I don't have any insight into whether HHS is ready in detail with that, but I'd echo what Larry said a few minutes ago here, that there will be a lot of demand on the healthcare system, and the experience has been, Massachusetts would be a good example, where you just can't get a primary. I mean, primary care is really difficult to come by because of all the new people coming into it. So I hope that the medical delivery system in the state is starting to address the issues of how are we going to manage this influx of people who've now got an insurance card.
Let me begin to pick up the questions from our audience and beyond here. The first one is from Chris in Cookeville, Tennessee. He says, with a hit television series, a film, Aussie transplant, can Nicole Kidman shooting it, is Nashville not America's coolest city? Okay. A question on America's coolest city.
Yes.
Nashville's America's coolest city.
We can agree on that.
All right. Everybody's in agreement on that.
Brilliant.
Let me get another here from Ben. This one's online. The Congressional Budget Office projects that 32 million more people will have insurance by 2019. Will this increased demand for health care place a burden on the system? And how can healthcare organizations prepare for this influx of patients? Dr. Riley, to you.
Absolutely. The governor just said it. We are going to have a stress point in the healthcare system, and particularly around primary care. That is your family physician, your pediatrician for your kids, OBGYN in some parts of the country. We know that there's going to be significant shortages. The problem is, in the academic health science center world, we've not been able to produce enough physicians, so we do need to be more broad-minded about who can provide primary care. And I think you're now seeing that physicians are more embracing of nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, et cetera, because we know we can't do it alone, that there is enough work for us to do as healthcare professionals to get people into the system, get them the preventive care they need, and hopefully prevent some things down the line that, that could be more disastrous.
I want to be sure I understand what you're saying. So it won't be necessarily medical doctors who they'll be seeing when they come in. It's going to be nurse practitioners.
Oh, absolutely. They're, you know, primary care can be delivered by great physicians, but also by great nurses and great nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. And in some areas, it's more economical to have a physician assistant, to have a nurse practitioner. So, we think that this has to be looked upon in a very broad ecumenical sense, if you will, that we have to get primary care to rural areas, to inner city areas, to areas that are traditionally been underserved. And it's not just going to be physicians. Physicians are always going to be a key piece, but it's going to be more broad than that.
Larry Van Horn, Vanderbilt, of course, has huge medical facilities. What about these numbers that are expected to come in? Do we have the capacity to care for them? And what are the implications? If they show up as invited, what does it mean for how health care is delivered?
Well, we'll be very challenged under the traditional delivery model and executing healthcare delivery the way we have for the last 20 or 30 years.
In what respect? I mean, we make appointments, we go in, we see a nurse, then a doctor, then we get some advice and we go. Is that going to change?
It's going to have to change. That's not the model of efficiency. And one of the necessary byproducts of having this bolus of new patients come into the system is we're going to have to innovate. We're going to have to fundamentally change the way we go about service delivery. We've had tremendous technological innovation in the world of healthcare over the last 30 years, but we've had relatively little change in the way we go about treating the patient, how that takes place, where it takes place, and as Dr. Riley said, who does it. And I have great hopes that those pressures will push us to change and innovate in ways that can generate a sustainable long-run kind of delivery solution.
You're worried about sustainability here. The primary impetus for this reform seems to have been care about concern with people who were simply uncovered. And, you know, Dr. Riley says, look, we've got inner city populations, we've got populations of color, we've got populations just simply low income. If not this, then what?
So we definitely have both access and cost issues. Mm-hmm. And the healthcare reform legislation was very much focused on the access side and set aside the cost side. That was a choice. One could say, let's address the cost side, and then we'll fill in afterwards with the access. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to now step forward and address the cost side. Otherwise, well, the expansions that we're currently engaging in are going to have to be pulled back. And that's going to be a challenge.
Governor Bredesen, I thought that Obamacare was supposed to help address the cost side. I thought that was built into the cake here.
Well, I would certainly disagree with that. There's a few things in there which are supposed to address that, but I think they are cost management or value management. I guess I'd prefer to put it light. They're not things that have got the real teeth that it'll take to really change that curve. My concern earlier that I was expressing was, you know, when you have to get some things from providers, for example, or hospitals and doctors and drug companies, the time to do that is when you have something to give. It's like if you're a union, the time to get something you want is when you're going to give up something, and likewise a business owner. We let this whole thing go by with putting a huge amount of new money in the system and bringing people in and didn't ask for any of the real things we need to get to.
Like what?
Being much more efficient in negotiating and hard-nosed about purchasing drugs in this country. I mean, we have a system in this country in which basically Medicare is, you know, is...
They're supporting the hall for that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's basically prohibited from going out and negotiating the best possible prices. And as governor, if I go out and refuse to negotiate or take bids or anything to buy something, I go to jail. On the medical side of the thing with drugs, that's the way the law reads. You have to go about it. Those are things that have got to change if you have any hope of bending the curve.
Why has that stayed that way? I was reading this afternoon that maybe that's because of the heavy, heavy lobbying that goes on by the health industry in Washington, bigger than the defense industry,
really?
Bigger than oil and gas.
Good, right?
What do you know? What do you know? How do you get out of that?
My eyes have been opened.
Yeah.
Here,
the scales have fallen away.
That's right.
need sunglasses over here. How do we get out of that?
It is. I mean, in the end, the Congress is going to have to do that. I mean, the lobbying on the part of the drug industry, just to pick on them for a minute, was enormous. There were 3 drug industry lobbyists. I remember the number for every member of Congress during the time that stuff was going on. And they've got a wonderful business model. They get to patent stuff and put it out there, and it's then our moral obligation to pay whatever price they set for it. We don't buy anything else that way in this country, and we shouldn't be buying something as important as drugs.
Dr. Riley, we of course have support there again. We, of course, in this country have not-for-profit and for-profit health care. You've called Nashville the for-profit health care capital of America. There is a lot right here, based here and active here. Does Obamacare look different if you're nonprofit or for-profit? Does it have a different profile, a different appeal?
No, not at all. And I'm very fortunate to serve on the HCA board, and it's amazing that even though
it's a gigantic healthcare operator all over.
Gigantic, but it's amazing to me that the similarities between the nonprofit world where I work and spend most of my time and then my service on the HCA board, it's pretty amazing how similar their outlook is in terms of wanting to get paid for the services that hospitals provide, whether they be for-profit or nonprofit, a big thrust for better quality care. The governor's written wonderfully and eloquently about the fact that we have quality issues. The quality issues are the same in a for-profit or a nonprofit setting. We want to get people healthier. We want to get them into the healthcare system. We want them taken care of correctly, without any complications. So again, I think there's really no big divide or chasm between the way for-profit and nonprofit are viewing the healthcare reform.
But don't we have a fundamental tension here? We want to contain costs. We want to bring down costs, and yet, if you're a for-profit operation in healthcare, you've got to make that profit. Even if you're not-for-profit, we've been reading recently, you know, some very big kind of virtual profit margins in those outfits. HCA, your president, I was reading, makes something like $46 million in compensation and stock options. That's a lot of dough. Isn't there a tension between bringing down costs and feeding a for-profit system or even a not-for-profit system that has certain expectations of how it's officers are going to be compensated?
Sure. And, you know, we've had this debate in healthcare for years. And I think, again, the governor's written about this, a need for an economic tension. That is probably an appropriate economic tension, that we have a mix of for-profit and non-profit healthcare organizations and facilities, and that folks have the choice to access the type of healthcare they need. Again, Obamacare does not take that away from anybody, although some people would suggest.
Some thought it should.
Should.
Universal health care.
Some folks thought it does, and it really doesn't. It still preserves the best of what I would refer to both worlds. And I think there's, believe you me, with 32 million more folks coming into the healthcare system, I think there's room for all types of healthcare organizations to really contribute.
Larry Van Horn, I flew down from Boston with a doctor out of Nashville who said he expects hospitals should welcome this because they have many patients who come in now to the emergency room who do not have coverage, and they end up paying for that care. If they're covered by the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that should be revenue from those patients instead of just expense.
True, but that's a partial equilibrium kind of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to be
pointy-headed. Yeah.
But propeller head there, Larry.
Bald head. We're following, but elaborate.
Here's the challenge. At the same time that's happening, we have the market for private health insurance moving towards greater patient cost sharing, where they're holding the individuals more accountable for out-of-pocket costs, whether it's co-pays, deductibles, co-insurance, and those numbers are rising. And we have now an industry where for the last 40 years people have gotten used to the idea that insurance is going to pay the bill. Now they're going to have to start paying more and more of that bill, and they're not used to it. And an increasing share of the bad debt in hospitals is shifting from the people who are uninsured to the people who are insured but aren't paying their co-pays, co-insurance, and deductibles. So even having insurance is not the answer here when people are unwilling to pay for the services and their obligation that they have out of pocket. It's just changing. It's moving from one hand to the other.
Will there be co-pays for people covered under through the exchanges, just like there would be for people?
Yes, there will be.
So that's there.
Yes.
They'll be chipping in that way.
If people pay them.
And if they don't, they'll be served anyway because That's the requirement?
That's kind of what our norm is in our industry.
But they end up at the emergency room already. That won't really be different.
No, it won't be different. But for all the other services that they consume, whether it's going to a physician office visit, whether it's going to get outpatient imaging, more and more patients have to share a greater share of that burden, and they're not tending to pay it the way that we need them to.
We'll see what comes in the era of Obamacare. 6 months until enrollment begins. Next January, coverage. Larry Van Horn, Dr. Wayne Riley, Governor Phil Bredesen, and the audience here in the hall of the Tennessee Performing Arts Center. This is On Point, and we'll be right back after a short break. Great to have all of you right here with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with a special edition of On Point before a live audience at the Tennessee Performing Arts Center in Nashville, Tennessee. We are talking about Obamacare. It is on the way. 6 months until enrollment begins. October 1st, millions more Americans to be covered. Lots of questions still. Lots of resistance still at the same time as it is coming on. We've got a great panel with us tonight. Former Tennessee Governor Phillip Bredesen is with us, author of Fresh Medicine, How to Fix, Reform, and Build a Sustainable Healthcare System. Governor, it's great to have you. Dr. Wayne Riley is with us, President, CEO, and Professor of Internal Medicine at Meharry Medical College. And Lawrence Van Horn is here from Vanderbilt University's Owen Graduate School of Management. We've got a great crowd and lots of questions. Some very straightforward. Let's see. Dr. Riley, let me give this one to you. This is Daniel from Nashville. I'm a regular middle-class guy working in Nashville. What are the top three effects that the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, will have on me, good or bad?
Well, let's start with the good. In terms of preventive services, some of the things that previous insurance programs would not allow Daniel to access in terms of preventive services are included in the bill. So,
can we back up for a second? Yeah. Daniel's been very broad. I'm a regular middle-class guy. Does that mean he'll even qualify?
Sure, but because remember, the insurance plans, whether you access it through the exchanges or through your private insurer, are going to have sort of a minimum level of benefits, and they'll be tiered by colors, bronze, silver, platinum, if you really want to.
Sort of like the Olympics.
Exactly, mm-hmm. So you can get the three medals, but you pick your medal color, and it does confer a sort of a standard set of benefits, Daniel. So you will be able to tier your health care to what you feel you for you and your family in terms of what you want. If you want a little more, you can get a little platinum plan.
And the higher you go up that medals chart, the more you pay.
That's correct.
And will the government subsidize you? It depends on where your income stands.
Well, the government, as I understand, will only subsidize to the bronze plan or the silver plan.
Bronze,
the basic plan.
Okay.
But if you are in a socioeconomic situation where you can get more, then you can pay for more. So again, this retains choice. Remember, one of the great hallmarks of our system is choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so the consumer will have the ability to choose. So Daniel, you'll be able to choose the type of health care you need, the program that fits you and your family.
Now, if he's been covered already through his employer, will that change?
Well, you know, that's a little bit of a moving target. I think that the data is mixed, and I think Larry probably wants to weigh in on this. The larger employers, at least the preliminary indications are that larger employers will not make too much of a change. But I think the governor and Larry will tell you that the really curious thing is whether smaller employers or over time, if larger employers start to migrate back into the exchange, and then we have a sustainability problem. And I agree with Larry, that is, and I think the governor agrees, that is sort of on the horizon. If this trend sort of quickens, could really provide some financial challenge to the program down the line.
Governor Bredesen, as a politician, mayor, and governor, you would have been sensitive to the interest of somebody like Daniel, regular middle-class guy. What's your first reaction to his question here? You know, top effects for me as a regular middle-class guy, good or bad, of Obamacare coming in?
First of all, I think the word you're looking for is statesman, not politician, isn't it?
At this point, I know you've graduated. Yes, sir. Yes, great statesman.
I say to him a couple of things. I say to him first of all, I think it opens up your choice of ways to access the healthcare system. I think it provides a very nice safety net for you on the good side, in the sense of you may have a job now, but you may become become unemployed. It's happened to a lot of people mm-hmm. over these last few years.
Sure has.
And this really provides a much more solid and much more accessible kind of safety net for people in that when you fall in that category. I think on the downside, I think almost certainly you're going to find find it harder to get a primary care physician.
Because they'll just
because
be too busy?
They're going to be busy and so on. And then ultimately, I mean, I agree with Larry. I mean, the thing is it's constructed now, taken together with Medicare and Medicaid, has the country on just a completely unsustainable path. There's no way to continue what it is we have, and that means there's going to be some, you know, some rough times ahead when we try to make the changes that it's going to take just to be able to pay for this stuff. And, you know, that has its effects on you as well.
Larry Van Horn, near term, our middle-class audience member here, you think they'll be better off?
Well, it depends on health status, how old he is. There's concerns because of the way the health care reform law is written, constraints on your ability to underwrite, that good risks, young people will end up having to pay more than they otherwise would in an effort to cross-subsidize kind of the older folks or people who are less healthy. And so if he's a young, healthy middle-aged or younger individual, his premiums could go up significantly.
If he's younger, they may, but then that assumes he's currently covered, which he may not be. Here's a question from Eloise. She says, I'm a 55-year-old female. I work for a small business with wonderful owners. I earn a good income, but the company does not offer a health insurance benefit. After my husband left 6 years ago, we've remained married solely so I could be covered on his health insurance through his employer. I mean, people have gone through some real gymnastics. We all know that. Yeah. She says, I'm generally healthy, take care of myself, but I have a couple of conditions which render me uninsurable. He's filed for divorce now, which means I'll have to pay high COBRA rates to have some kind of coverage. She writes, all in caps, I think I'm one of the people this law was passed to protect. But she says, it's my understanding the changes mean I can't be denied coverage. But how will the costs of this be covered so that my insurance is affordable? Is there an income threshold which could mean that I earn too much to qualify for the affordable coverage, therefore would have to pay an unmanageable premium? Dr. Riley, can you make your way through that?
Well, great question. And again, you know, Americans have become very skillful at workarounds. And unfortunately, she's had a workaround in terms of trying to keep insurance vis-a-vis her marital status. But again, as the governor pointed out earlier, depending upon your income, you may be able to qualify for a subsidy to access a private health plan. Again, if you're choosing, not the governor's choosing, not the HHS's choosing, but you're choosing based upon that subsidy. And if you make more money, obviously you won't get that subsidy, but you'll still have access to the plan. Pre-existing conditions will be covered.
So that she doesn't have to worry about.
She doesn't have to worry about that. Pre-existing is covered. If she's had high claims history, she's covered. She can't be denied insurance because she's been a high user of insurance based on her condition. So those are the things that, if you remember during the debate, the things that Americans dislike the most about the American healthcare system is that they could be dropped, you know, for arbitrary or apparent arbitrary reasons, that they could not access care because they had multiple conditions. Again, Obamacare takes care of that.
Here's one from Samantha. Larry, I'll bring it to you. She says, yesterday, Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam announced our state will not be taking federal ACA funds to expand Medicaid. As an uninsured 20-something, I've been looking forward to the new health insurance exchange and voucher program. How will our state's denial of accepting these funds impact these programs? Samantha asks this out of Tennessee. Of course, there are many other states where this has happened.
Well, and this isn't clear yet. I mean, I know the governor here is still in negotiations with HHS and is hopeful that he will be able to have the funds from the federal government to provide premium support for individuals to purchase through the exchanges. So this is still to be played out.
You know, the political game, and I'll put this to you, our statesman, former governor, former politician. Here's Bloomberg writing, Bloomberg News, writing about the Republican strategy on Obamacare, having moved from repeal and replace, which we heard a lot during the campaign, to resist and annoy. Well, there's a lot of resistance going on. You've got Republican leaders predicting that this will crumble under its own weight, that it won't actually get fully up on the rails, that it may come apart at the seams. What do you say to all that?
You know, I think it's, and in this case, I'm criticizing Republicans, but certainly Democrats have done similar things in other areas. But this is the law of the land today. I mean, it has been passed. The Supreme Court has approved it. And I think anybody who really take seriously their job as an elected representative has got to recognize that and stop this resist and annoy and those kinds of things and move on with how we fix it. But, you know, I'd also say that a part of my critique of its passage in the first place was that it was done so without any sort of serious bipartisan support. And I know it's a difficult environment in Washington, but when Social Security was passed, it had most of the Democrats and half of the Republicans voting for it. When Medicare was passed, it was very contentious for anybody mm-hmm. old enough to remember that. It still had the Democrats and half of the Republicans. That just takes it out of the political sphere. I mean, it's once it's done, it's a done deal. Today, the way this was passed was sort of no Republican support anywhere. You can't run for president or office as a Republican without promising to annoy and repeal and all those kinds of things. I mean, to me, the responsibility of a political executive, a governor or a president for that matter, is to do things not just to get them done, but to get them done in a way that they can be sustained, that, you know, that they've got broad enough support in the country that you don't spend the next 10 or 20 years or 30 years trying to undo them, that they've got that kind of sustainability.
Is that ever going to be possible in healthcare with all the conflicting interests here and big money and big politics around it?
Oh, sure. I think it is absolutely possible to do that when you take it out of this D versus R thing. Would you have had to make some compromise for Republicans for some particular things that they wanted? Absolutely. But, you know, that's what Johnson did with Medicare. That's what Roosevelt did with Social Security. It's not necessarily a bad thing to do. But when you pass something in that fashion, you just kind of put the seeds of its own, you know, constant, you know, if not destruction, at least constant sickness, you just build it into the system. And we've got that now, but I really do think that people need to recognize it is the law of the land. We need, whatever our feelings about it, we need to move on and improve it, not look backwards and criticize
Dr.
it.
Riley, of course, there's support for that. Governor Rick Perry in Texas told Forbes magazine, he said, the idea that we'd expand and put more money and more people into a broken system is not unlike putting another 1,000 people on the Titanic. He said, you know how this is going to turn out. This is Rick Perry, of course, Texas, and it's going to be a disaster. But Forbes, Bloomberg goes on then to observe, says, one might observe that the healthcare system in Texas, which has the nation's highest rate of uninsured residents at 24%, is already a disaster. The recalcitrance of Perry and Republican state lawmakers has the potential to make matters much worse. It may not be perfect, but we have had this huge uninsured population. So I've seen you say, Dr. Riley, that Obamacare may have hit it 80-20. You know, 80% okay and 20% that needs fixing. Here's a listener, Esteban Carlos, says, how easy or difficult will it be to remedy the nuanced problems of Obamacare? That's assuming we keep the fundamentals of the Health Care Act in place. How would you improve it while keeping it intact?
Well, again, I know the Texas situation well. Before coming to Tennessee, I spent 14 years in Texas, and Texas does have the highest uninsured rate in the country. And the city of Houston, where I practiced in the inner city and worked in the Academic Health Science Center there, had the highest uninsured rate of any major American city in the country. So it's a particularly thorny problem in Texas that I think is compounded by the governor's position vis-a-vis the expansion. But again, I think the governor's dead on target. We've got to get past, you know, this resist and obstruct. This is the law of the land. Let's try to get Republicans and Democrats and all the various groups, whether it's pharmaceutical companies and hospitals and physicians and nurses together, try to make this thing work. You know, no legislation is perfect. No legislation. And if you look at the legislative history of Medicare has been improved over the years as well. And Medicare is one of the most popular federal programs that there is. Problems it has, though. But again, if you ask any American, you know, Medicare is extremely popular. Now, that's separate from the structural issues that the governor, I think Larry, will mention soon in terms of the sustainability of the Medicare program. But it's a good model in terms of how we just need to move on and try to fix this thing and really embrace the 80-20. Let's focus on the 20% of the bill that's problematic.
Larry Van Horn, the critique I read from you says that would be nice, but it is not sustainable even for very long, that the runway here for Obamacare is, I don't know, kind of a handful of years as you look at it.
Well, I think that's right. I think the common problem with Medicare, with Medicaid, with the expansion through the exchanges, they all share a common thread, and that is we have this insatiable desire to consume healthcare, and we want to give lots of healthcare to people, but we just don't have the to tax our citizenry and pay for it. And at some point in time, common to all of these programs will be a requirement that we say we can only pay for what we can support in the long run. And that's going to require us sitting down and prioritizing how we spend our limited funds and rationalizing those federal tax dollars, those state tax dollars to support our programs. Take Medicare, for example. We do 460,000 knee replacements a year paid for by Medicare. That makes a lot of people better off. They're in a lot less pain. They get around a lot better.
What are you suggesting? A lot more limping Americans?
I'm suggesting more limping Americans, yeah. Well, I'm not a statesman, mind you.
Nor a politician, clearly.
No, clearly not a politician. The beauty of tenure.
Yes.
Tenure.
But seriously, you're kind of saying, get over it, Americans. You can't have that knee replacement?
What I'm saying is that it's impossible for our government to provide unlimited funds to support anything that our medical system has the ability to do for our citizenry. And when we have to make priorities, I think we all want to ensure that a base level of care is available to all Americans, regardless of their income, their nationality, their immigration status. But we can't support giving unlimited amounts of care to everybody, given the technological advances in medicine.
Governor Bredesen, our time grows very short. Do you think people are going to feel that they're offered unlimited quantities of medicine under Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act? Is that what the nation is going to feel like? We all have everything now?
I don't think it's anything new. I think people already feel that they're offered unlimited quantities of care under sort of any health insurance. It's that lack of tension, of economic tension, health insurance, that's really at the core of why we use so much health insurance and why it's so expensive. That, in the end, is what's got to be changed in some way, whether it's inside of Obamacare or a Blue Cross plan or a company plan or anything else. We need to move down that road.
It's coming, and it's coming very fast. October 1st, enrollment begins. In January, the new coverage begins. Dr. Riley, we began right here, but do you see Nashville? Are you ready?
Well, I think we are going to be ready. And, you know, when I think about it in a national context, you know, in our political discourse, we often hear about America's exceptionalism. And I would like to see is that this is the beginning of America's medical and healthcare exceptionalism, that we take this opportunity with this landmark legislation, imperfect may it be, to really focus on the health of America, because that's the future of these young kids. It's the future of our states, our communities, our organizations, and it's a wonderful way to do it.
There's the readiness. We'll see how it rolls out. Dr. Wayne Riley of Meharry Medical College, Lawrence Van Horn of Vanderbilt's Owen Graduate School of Management, former Governor of Tennessee, Philip Bredesen. It's been great to have all of you with us. Thank you so very much. And to the audience in the hall in Nashville, wonderful. WPLN, thanks for having us down. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.